KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Suzanne Potter, Edwin J. Vieira, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Up next.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. I'll start with three items from Europe. First, tools of Moscow, Germany's AfD, and the Russian Orthodox Church. Russia's foreign ministry has a plan for defeating the West, and Switzerland to vote on neutrality and host a peace conference. Tools of Moscow? The Alternative for Germany Party, the AfD, which is against weapons deliveries to Ukraine and calls for an end to sanctions on Russia, is not only vying to become the second strongest German party in European parliamentary elections, it is poised to become the leading force in three eastern state elections in Germany this autumn. That gives the AfD the possibility, though unlikely, that it could take control of a state government. Some German legislators are wary of sitting beside AfD delegates in parliament since, as reported by the New York Times, quote, in the past few months alone, a leading AfD politician was accused of taking money from pro-Kremlin strategists. One of the party's parliamentary aides was exposed as having links to a Russian intelligence operative, and some of its state lawmakers flew to Moscow to observe Russia's state-managed elections. The problem of Russian influence operations goes beyond Germany. There is a widespread belief in European circles that Russian money is finding its way into the pockets of quite a few politicians. After all, the far right is in the ascendancy in Hungary and Italy and wields considerable power in France, Netherlands, and elsewhere. With European Parliament elections upcoming this summer, nervousness about Russian infiltration is widespread. Then there's the Russian Orthodox Church. Newsweek reports, quote, the Russian Orthodox Church has approved a document that deems President Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine a holy war. The declaration came during a Congress of the World Russian People's Council, which met at the site of Moscow's Cathedral of Christ the Savior, a focal point for the Orthodox faith in Russia. In February 2022, Patriarch Kirill said that Ukraine and Belarus were part of Russian lands and called the Ukrainians who were defending themselves against Russian aggression forces of evil, pitching the war as a battle for the future of Christianity. The backdrop to this story comes from an article in the May issue of The Atlantic by Robert F. Wirth. He takes us back to 2018, when Patriarch Kirill met with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, the senior figure in the Orthodox Christian world. Kirill tried to persuade Bartholomew not to recognize a new and independent Orthodox Church in Kiev, which would divorce Ukraine's church from Russia's. Bartholomew rejected Kirill's appeal, which parroted Putin's claim that Ukraine and Russia are indivisible. The Ukrainians don't feel comfortable under the control of Russia and desire full ecclesiastical independence, just as they have political independence, Bartholomew said. An angry Kirill returned home, no doubt to an equally angry Putin. Russia's foreign ministry has a plan for defeating the West. The Washington Post has acquired a secret Russian foreign ministry document entitled The Foreign Policy Concept of the Russian Federation, dated in April 2023, that calls for an offensive information campaign and other measures. The document is said to have been provided by a European intelligence service. The campaign will span, quote, the military, political, economic, and trade and informational psychological spheres, the document says, against a, quote, coalition of unfriendly countries led by the United States. We need to continue adjusting our approach to relations with unfriendly states. It's important to create a mechanism for finding the vulnerable points of their external and internal policies with the aim of developing practical steps to weaken Russia's opponents, the document says. In one sense, this document merely confirms what has long been known about Russia's strategy for weakening the Western alliance and interfering in European and U.S. politics. It also confirms the importance of a victory in Ukraine for Russia, saying the outcome of the war in Ukraine will, quote, to a great degree determine the outlines of the future world order. A line that, like that, takes us straight back to the Cold War, when U.S.-Soviet confrontations in Berlin, Vietnam, and Cuba were portrayed in both Moscow and Washington as defining struggles between democracy and communism. Yet the document also states that, quote, Russia does not consider itself an enemy of the West and has no ill intentions toward it. To say the least, that's a bewildering statement. Switzerland to vote on neutrality and host a peace conference. A right-wing party in Switzerland is moving for a popular vote to affirm the country's neutrality in its constitution. The Swiss government decided to impose sanctions on Russia in 2022. The rightists object that sanctions violate neutrality and want to roll them back. Corporations there agree, arguing that taking Ukraine's side is harming business. A vote will not take place for some time, as it must go through various bureaucratic procedures before being allowed. Switzerland also plans to host an international peace conference on Ukraine this summer. Russia has already indicated it won't attend, but Ukraine's President Zelensky has indicated he will be there and will present his country's ideas for a peace settlement. China has agreed to attend following a plea from German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who said, quote, China's word carries weight in Russia. I have therefore asked President Xi to influence Russia so that Putin finally calls off his senseless campaign, withdraws his troops, and ends this terrible war. Xi has offered four principles for a settlement in Ukraine: focus on peace and stability rather than selfish gains, cool down the situation in Ukraine rather than add fuel to the fire, establish conditions for restoring peace rather than aggravating the situation, and fourth, reduce the negative impact that the war is having on the world economy. Like a previous Chinese peace plan, this one is vague and partial to Russia, but at least China will be represented at the conference. In other news, China's rising GDP obscures important facts about the economy. GDP, gross domestic product, is probably the most widely used indicator of a country's economy. China's GDP always gets attention because it seems to increase impressively every year. But a new study reveals another side of the picture. Its household income isn't growing anywhere near as fast as GDP. Thus, news that China's economy rebounded in the first quarter of 2024 needs to be taken with a grain of salt. China's National Bureau of Statistics said the economy grew 1.6% in the first quarter over the previous 3 months. That translates to an annual rate of about 6.6%. Heavy investment in manufacturing for exports, a 10% increase from a year ago, fueled the latest growth. But for some countries and for many Chinese, that is not good news. Chinese goods are flooding world markets, outpricing locally produced goods. This, by the way, is what Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen complained about when she was in Beijing. But at home, youth unemployment and consumer spending in China are not helped by an export-led economy. China's real estate market continues to be in a deep slump. People can't afford to buy homes or rent apartments the way they once could. As two specialists on China's economy wrote recently in Foreign Affairs magazine, quote, after two decades of strong investment-led growth, China now needs consumption-led growth. Further investment will have diminishing returns unless China can consume more at home. Yet over the past 2 years, the opposite has happened. Unable to sell goods to domestic buyers, Chinese companies are exporting their excess production abroad, unquote. China's economists seem to agree on at least one point. There's much work to be done to fix the economy. Are China and Taiwan brethren? Earlier this month, China's leader met with Taiwan's former president, Ma Ying-jeou, in Beijing. Xi Jinping clearly intended to push the notion of a shared destiny, in contrast with the frequent harassment of Taiwan by fighter jet overflies and the long-standing Chinese policy of reunification as one China. But Xi may be fighting a losing battle over a common China-Taiwan identity, especially if identity is based on ethnicity. Because for many decades, young people in Taiwan have been educated on the basis of a separate Taiwanese identity, with Taiwanese values and culture. Opinion polls have made clear for a long time that Taiwan's population overwhelmingly identifies as Taiwanese, not as Chinese or Chinese-Taiwanese. In short, the Taiwan Strait is more than a geographic barrier. It signifies one China and one Taiwan. Whether that barrier will ever dissolve may depend as much on changes on the mainland as on changes in Taiwan. The Solomon Islands votes. The 720,000 people of the nearly 1,000 islands that comprise the Solomons voted for a prime minister and parliament last week. Prime Minister Manasa Sogavare won a second term. He gained international attention when he switched diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to China in 2019 and then signed a secret security agreement with China in 2022 that provides China with port access but not a military base. Still, Sogavare's China policy has caused considerable consternation in Australia and the U.S., which used to have substantial ties to the Solomons. Anti-China politicians were able to score a win in the province of Malaita, despite a last-minute visit by a Chinese official. The official concluded a memorandum of understanding with the premier of the province, only to have him lose his election to a former premier who had refused to recognize China and had turned for aid to the United States. China invites the United States to nuclear strategy talks. China rarely takes the initiative on nuclear weapon matters, nor does it normally disclose its nuclear inventory or reveal nuclear strategic thinking. Nor, most relevant here, has China ever accepted any kind of nuclear talks with the U.S. So it's a rare event when, as recently happened, Beijing invited the U.S. and other countries to talks on a nuclear policy of no first use of those weapons. The Biden administration has yet to respond to the invitation, and the president may be of two minds on it. On one hand, he has supported no first use in the past, but on the other, the U.S. has consistently opposed the principle, preserving the right to use a nuclear weapon first under certain circumstances. On the environmental side, global coral reef bleaching is accelerating. As reported by the Washington Post, quote, scientists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, and International Coral Reef Initiative say the world is currently experiencing its fourth global bleaching event, the second in the last decade. All the world's oceans are part of the bleaching phenomenon, in which coral turns white in response to loss of algae, depriving fish of essential food. I'm told, however, on the good side, that scientists on Hawaii's Coconut Island are growing super coral to endure hotter, more acidic oceans from global warming, aiming to combat the dire health of reefs, crucial for marine habitats and economies. Through assisted evolution, they expose coral to stressors to bolster survival rates. Yet scalability challenges persist amid escalating coral bleaching events and the imperative to curb greenhouse gas emissions for long-term climate resilience. Israel's miscalculation. Listeners may recall my criticism of Israel for its strategic blunder in attacking Iran's embassy in Damascus, an act that should have anticipated an Iranian military response. Now Israel has admitted to having miscalculated. According to the New York Times, quote, the Israelis had badly miscalculated, thinking that Iran would not react strongly, according to multiple American officials who were involved in high-level discussions after the attack, a view shared by a senior Israeli official, unquote. Moreover, Washington was caught off guard, having been notified about the impending attack only moments before it was carried out. The Times reports, quote, publicly, U.S. officials voiced support for Israel, but privately they expressed anger that it would take such aggressive action against Iran without consulting Washington, unquote. This is a classic case of a smaller ally creating major trouble for its bigger partner. Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy trapped the U.S. into supporting it against the predictable Iranian counterattack. The perpetrator of the incident became the victim. Finally, one update. Niger invites the United States to leave. After months of contentious discussion, the coup government of Niger has ordered the U.S. to leave its major counterterrorism base. This move comes after Niger, like its Central African neighbors Burkina Faso and Mali, invited Russian military advisors in. The U.S. military must now explore options for re-siting the base, which has over 1,000 soldiers. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Well, you are listening to Cable News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am speaking with Sarah Wolk, the executive director of Equal Vote Coalition, about star voting, the campaign for it in Eugene, and a statewide initiative petition. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me here, and thanks for covering voting reform.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. So, to start, for folks who don't know, what is star voting?
So, star voting is just a preference voting type of way to vote. So, instead of choosing one only, with star voting, when you go to vote, you're able to score your candidates from 0 stars up to 5 stars for your favorite. So it lets you show your preference order and also how much or how little you like the candidate, so that whether or not your favorite can win, your vote always makes a difference.
So take me through this. As, you know, say I'm the voter, I'm ranking my favorites. I have a 5, I have a 3, and I have a 1. How do those end up getting counted towards the candidates in question?
Yeah, so the instructions are super simple. You score your candidates 5 stars for your favorite, 0 for your last choice, and then score the other candidates as desired. You can give equal scores if you like candidates equally, and you can also leave people blank. Then star voting is counted in a simple two-step process. So it sort of works like a primary and then a general election all in one. And for our local elections, like star voting for Eugene, it actually would completely eliminate the need for a primary election. So the way it's counted, you add up all the stars that everyone was given and find the two highest scoring candidates overall. Those are your finalists. Then your vote automatically goes to the finalist that you prefer. So each voter counts as one vote in the runoff. And the finalist with the most votes wins.
So what are some of the potential benefits to switching to this method of voting as opposed to, you know, what most folks are used to, which is called like first past the post?
Right. So with our current system, it's very simple. Some would say simplistic, and we do like how simple it is. But the problem is it really only works if there's two candidates or two political parties in the race. If there's more than two candidates with the current system, you run the risk of having a majority coalition who ends up splitting the vote and ending up essentially divided and conquered. So that's the kind of familiar conundrum that many of us have found ourselves in, where we have a favorite, but we don't know if they're actually electable. So we might want to consider voting for the front runner on our side who it looks like maybe has a better chance of winning.
I know that when ranked choice voting, because that's kind of another similar method to star voting, when that's been brought up in different contexts and certain localities have adopted it, there are some expected outcomes about the types of candidates that might result or might benefit from this system. Is that the same thing with star voting as well?
Yeah, and so the current system has polarization really baked right into it. Anytime you do have an election with three or more candidates, you run the risk of splitting the vote. And when that happens, it tends to favor your polarizing outlier. And so over time, electing more and more polarizing candidates, you end up with two-party domination. So ranked choice voting attempts to address that, but it was invented about 150 years ago, and it does mitigate some of these issues. But what we've seen is even in countries that have used it the longest, they're still two-party dominated. They still do elect more polarizing winners than what they should, and sometimes non-representative winners. So we've actually seen that with ranked choice voting around the country, where we've had a couple of races where counterintuitively the candidate who was actually preferred over all others by the voters didn't win the election. So in Alaska, that happened the first time it was used, and there's been a really pretty comprehensive national backlash against ranked choice voting for getting these kinds of sideways outcomes, and they can happen anytime you have close competitive races. So that's really where star voting comes in.
Right. Well, can I clarify one thing? Because you mentioned should, that there's an outcome that should happen and it didn't happen. Can you clarify what you mean by that?
Yeah. So in voting science or electoral science, the idea of like the accurate winner is the candidate who best represents the will of the people. So for instance, if you're ranking the candidates and there is a candidate who is preferred over all others, that candidate should really win, according to the ballots themselves. But ranked choice voting actually doesn't count all the rankings. So in close competitive races, it can sometimes get outcomes that just don't make sense if you really crunch the data.
Well, as you mentioned, star voting is on the May ballot in Eugene. Can you tell me a little bit about this campaign?
Yeah, so we really like to look at it as the evolution of the same movement. Again, star voting was invented to just go further to deliver on the goals behind the ranked choice voting movement while still actually addressing valid criticisms with the older method. So here in Eugene, we've been working on this for a decade and made it on the ballot this year with a really robust grassroots campaign Over a third of our signatures were collected by volunteers. They were all collected by Oregonians. And we couldn't be more proud of our team and what we've done here, trying to really put star voting on the map and pilot a modern, more robust option.
Is there any event in Eugene's electoral history that sort of spurred this move towards star voting, or as sort of a counterfactual as to why it might be necessary?
Yeah. I think a lot of places do move to voting reform as kind of a referendum on their current elected leadership. And in Eugene, that actually wasn't the motivation. It's actually the opposite. So Oregon has a really long history of leading on voting reform. Oregon was the first state to adopt the primary, to adopt the ballot initiative, to do motor voter automatic registration, vote by mail. So really the final piece of the puzzle for the Oregon model is to have a voting method that doesn't suffer from vote splitting and spoiler effect, and that really does empower voters to vote their conscience. So we're hoping to pass this in Eugene first and then use Eugene as a model for the rest of the nation, because star voting really does scale well.
So what happens if Eugene's voters in May, what happens if you guys pass it?
Well, if we do pass it, that's kind of where we get to the fun part here. So we've been in campaign mode, trying to really get the message out to voters, doing peer-to-peer conversations and presentations and town halls. We just had a series launch hosted by the Library and League of Women Voters. But if we do pass it, we're going to get to go work on voter education. And that's the part I'm really looking forward to.
Well, I understand that there is also a statewide initiative petition in circulation on star voting as well. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Star Voting for Oregon has been collecting signatures for well over a year now, and we have until July to make the ballot for this November. And so our hope is that with a win in Eugene, we're going to be able to kind of catapult that recognition and hopefully make it on the ballot for statewide so that we can consider star voting in general. And the benefits of star voting are really exponential as it scales. So one of the things I mentioned being different about star voting and ranked choice is that with star voting, it's all counted with addition, and it's all counted at the local level. So just like our current system, essentially, in terms of the votation details. So that's where I think star voting has something really powerful to offer compared to ranked choice voting that hopefully Oregon will consider and take seriously.
Where can our listeners find out more information if they're interested in your organization or in star voting more generally?
Yeah, our nonprofit is the Equal Vote Coalition, and you can find us online at equal.vote. If you want to learn more about star voting specifically, the website for that is starvoting.org.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to take us through this.
Thanks, Althea.
I have been speaking with Sarah Wolk, the executive director of Equal Vote Coalition, about star voting, the campaign in Eugene, and the statewide initiative petition. You have been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay with us.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive. It's taking place now through May